fanfare. That brings us to the Indie Week. I'm John Fetterson for the North Carolina Reading Service, providing this program for blind and print impaired listeners. The issue of Indie Week is May the 21st of 2026. And thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Our first article, a year after federal job cuts, workers in the Triangle are still picking up the pieces. Hundreds of careers across the Triangle were abruptly derailed a year ago as the federal government made sweeping cuts, offering buyouts to civil servants, eliminating grants, and dismantling organizations like the United States Agency for International Development, that's USAID. In a congressional district hardest hit by federal grant cuts, there's no clear way to measure the impact or where all those workers ended up. But the sense of loss is real. John Nicholson, 48, spoke to Indy during a break from his job at Weaver Street Market in Carrboro, where he has worked since last June. In some ways, he sees it as a continuation of his 20-year career in international development, working to build a more resilient community, just on a hyper-local scale rather than global. He said, "That's one of the things I actually really liked about it. Here, it was very hands-on. Of course, the jobs are vastly different, but I like that too." Across the Triangle, the federal workforce dropped by about 12% between January of 25 and January of 26, according to an Indie analysis of federal job data. Hundreds more lost jobs in the private sector as federal contracts and grant dollars abruptly ended. A recent report by Axios showed that the Durham-Chapel Hill area lost about 3,800 jobs, while Raleigh-Cary grew by around 13,000 jobs, a discrepancy likely due to federal cuts. Durham Mayor Leo Williams told Indy, "We are the brains of this country, and we are being attacked by this dumb administration. And we see it at the dinner table. We're seeing it in the confidence of some of our most competent people. We're seeing it just trickle down and ripple through our local economy." Net job numbers give a glimpse of the impact, but the scale and nature of the cuts mean it is impossible to know exactly how many people were impacted. Lawmakers, government agencies, experts, and local chambers, no one has a hard number, but the cost is undeniable. Indy analyzed public data and spoke to former federal workers, union leaders, advocates, and elected officials to see where the Triangle's federal workers went after the cuts. Some asked not to be named, as they are still actively looking for jobs. Nicholson spent about two decades at John Snow Incorporated, JSI, a Boston-based consulting firm where every one of his projects was government-funded. On his last project, he served as the Knowledge Management and Communications Director for a program helping countries digitize, share, and track health data. Nicholson knew his job might be in danger after the 24 election, and he took his family to Disney World that Christmas while he still could, and on February 14th, 25, he lost his job. He's now doing some consulting again, as much as 30 hours a week, for a project out of the Netherlands, working on policy measures to improve diet and health. That's on top of his full-time job at Weaver Street, which provides insurance and gives him a chance to salvage local food for Food Not Bombs, another organization he became involved with after losing his job. Quote, "It was important to me, especially, to demonstrate for my kids that, you know, when you get knocked down, you pick yourself back up. And it doesn't mean you necessarily start where you left off." At the end of January 2025, there were 8,800 federal workers in Durham, Wake, and Orange counties. About half of them worked for the Veterans Health Administration. By the end of January 26, that number had dropped 12% to 7,750. The relatively stable VA workforce, however, masks even steeper declines in other areas. Environmental Protection Agency, for example, lost 26% of its local employees, dropping from 1,403 to 1,042. The agency's Research Triangle Park campus included a number of staff of the now shuttered Office of Research and Development. In Durham, the immigrant rights organization Siembra NC has asked local officials to study the full impacts of the cuts on the city. Quote, "It actually takes me back to the pandemic when there were folks who had never been unemployed and they would reach out to our office for assistance," said State Senator Natalie Murdoch, who represents parts of Chatham and Durham counties. In March, Murdoch visited Chapel Hill with the organization Oxfam, advocating to keep funding for international aid in the budget. She was invited, she said, because North Carolina has been so deeply impacted by federal aid cuts. A representative of the American Federation of Government Employees, AFGE, Local 3347, which represents EPA employees, said union membership had dropped from about 1,000 people to 700. The union said most of those people took buyouts rather than being laid off. Heather Hughes, president of AFGE Local 3509, which represents Social Security Administration employees in North Carolina and surrounding states, said a number of people took the offer of the Deferred Resignation Program last April, which offered an option of receiving pay for several months before departing the civil service. More followed in December. A freeze on hiring meant those who remain are stretched even thinner. Hughes said people didn't stop having babies and needing Social Security numbers and needing replacement cards, so the work increases, the staffing decreases. Then, there's the unknown number of workers who lost their jobs when federal contracts or grants ended abruptly. Some, like Nicholson, worked for organizations based out of state, making it nearly impossible to track. One of his colleagues who was laid off, also, Kate Sheehan, 48 years, said that of the 20 to 30 JSI employees who worked in the Triangle, only three kept their jobs. Sheehan said her family income dropped by two-thirds after the layoff. She's only recently picked up part-time work that matches her professional background. She has a doctorate from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and said, "I knew in sixth grade I wanted to be a Peace Corps volunteer and I wanted my career to be in public health. And so I knew my identity was going to go through the ringer and my mental health and everything was going to be a mess." Within the day of the layoff, she reached out to a triathlon coach, determined to find some positive outlet for her passion. And she completed the Wilmington Ironman last October. She said, "It literally, honestly saved me. Then in the background, I applied for a lot of jobs. I started waiting tables just to make money. I'm still waiting tables at Venable in Carrboro." As of last September, cuts at Research Triangle Institute International had impacted over 400 people in North Carolina. FHI 360 in Durham filed notice of 144 layoffs, while the American Institutes of Research filed notice on 19 layoffs as a result of grants and contracts being cut. UNC Chapel Hill lost 97 federally funded projects totaling almost $40 million. Despite efforts to move workers into different roles, 140 people were laid off as a result, said a university spokesperson. Duke University, North Carolina State, and North Carolina Central did not respond to requests for comment regarding the job impact. Not every local federal agency has seen such a mass exodus. There's about the same number of TSA workers at Raleigh-Durham International Airport as a year ago, said Mac Johnson, president of AFGE Local 449, which represents TSA staff. This is despite the quote, emotional roller coaster of repeated government shutdowns, he said. U.S. Representative Valerie Fouché, a Democrat who represents the 4th Congressional District, said she has seen the damage of the cuts. Quote, people either don't have their calls answered, don't have their questions answered, don't have their needs met, even services that are due to them because the people who perform the services aren't available. Where did they go? Finding where people are now is even harder than tallying the total number of lost jobs. Unemployment rates and the total labor force have remained fairly steady, according to state data and information from the Greater Durham Chamber of Commerce. In the place of hard data, everyone has anecdotes. Friends and former colleagues doing administrative work for an actuary, waiting tables, starting a travel agency, chasing the vanishingly few international development jobs alongside other overqualified candidates. Brianna Clark-Schwelm, executive director of North Carolina Global Health Alliance, said, I think it's pretty hard for people who haven't experienced it to imagine everything changing on a dime and not only losing your job, but then all of your job prospects everywhere disappearing as well. Through public layoff notices and her own personal network, Clark-Schwelm has confirmed 625 North Carolinians who lost jobs due to those cuts in U.S. aid. She declined to name any specific companies, but many of them were likely at places like Research Triangle Institute International. Still, she said that is an undercount due to the number of people who were working remotely. She said all of those people were people who had committed their lives to service, had committed their lives to making the world a safer and a healthier place. Some have been able to pivot very successfully, finding research work or jobs with local governments. Some left the state or even the country. Others managed to keep a job but are now underemployed. Emily Kojakova, 44, still works for the Inclusive Development Partners, a small woman-owned business with expertise in inclusion, particularly of people with disabilities, in development work. USAID funded about 90% of that company's projects. Initially, the company laid everyone off, then hired a few back as contractors to finish the non-USAID projects. Kojakova still has the same title, Senior Technical Advisor and Program Manager, but she's a part-time contractor now instead of a full-time employee. She has freelanced before, but it's harder now. Quote, the consulting field and opportunities are just so much more competitive because everybody's trying to do it now. People that lost their jobs, who want to stay in this work, who are passionate and skilled, they're all applying for the same small batch of independent consultancies. Some just decided it was time to retire. Nina Frankel, 67, was also employed remotely for JSI, one of several organizations she worked for her over 30-year career in international development. In that time, she worked on reproductive health, contraception, HIV, immunization, refugee health, quote, whatever came my way. But when she lost her job last February, she decided it was done. It was my life, and I was just going to do it till I couldn't do it anymore because I loved it so much. But the idea of starting looking for a job in a sector that no longer existed, you know, it was kind of daunting, and I was of age. I could retire. In the wake of the cuts, workers have found ways to support each other. Frankel and Kojakova both found others experiencing the same thing. Kojakova said it's been a really neat, supportive community, and some have pushed to be reinstated. Dr. Tom Lubin, 52, is unusual among the people that go from EPA locally because he did not take the deferred resignation offer. After 18 years with EPA's Office of Research and Development, he signed a protest letter in late June after hearing the division might be shuttered, which it later was. Within days of signing that letter, Lubin was placed on a 2-week administrative leave, which then stretched into months of limbo before he was officially fired last October. He said, "I just couldn't believe that because I signed this letter at home on my couch, on my phone, well within my First Amendment rights, I was being fired." He has appealed through the Federal Merit System Protection Board, and his case is ongoing. In an unattributed response to the Indy, EPA press office says it does not comment on ongoing litigation. Last December, Lubin started a remote position as a senior research scientist at the University of Michigan, a job that lets him stay in Durham, where he and his wife have lived since 2005, but he still wants to return to the EPA. He said, "My best case scenario is that I would be reinstated. I would like to say into my old job at EPA, but that no longer exists." All right, now let's please turn our attention to Durham. First, Durham cyclists mourn traffic deaths during Memorial Ride. John Talmadge, executive director of transit equity nonprofit Bike Durham, tends to stay even-keeled when presenting to large audiences or in front of the city council or even on subjects as emotionally charged as roadway deaths. But on Wednesday evening, Talmadge fought back tears as he addressed a pack of cyclists amassing at the CCB Plaza. He said to the crowd, "This is meaningful for me, because I've gotten to know family members of people who have been killed. Hearing their stories about the losses that they've suffered, it's really heartbreaking, and it's also motivating." Dozens of bike safety advocates gathered in downtown Durham on Wednesday to participate in the annual Ride of Silence. That's a national event held each year to memorialize victims of traffic violence who were killed or seriously injured while biking or walking. Communities across the country host local memorial rides to bring awareness to the issue. Bike Durham has led that ride in Durham for the last several years. They provided reflective vests, water, and black and red armbands signifying a connection to someone who was injured or killed on the road. Advocacy campaign organizer Gregory Williams opened the event by reading a list of people who had lost their lives due to traffic violence in the last few years, including 15-year-old Jack O'Shea, who was killed last month while riding his e-bike on Coal Mill Road after being struck by an alleged drunk driver. Riders left CCB Plaza on a 6-mile trek around the greater downtown Durham area. The group, riding on commuter bikes, e-bikes, and e-trikes, ranged from age 7 to 70. City councilors Javier Caballero, Carl Rist, Nate Baker, and Matt Kopeck, as well as Transportation Director Sean Egan, also joined the ride. Chris Perlstein, known for his Restless Roxborough project, documenting speeders on Roxborough Street, constructed a wooden frame mounted to the front of his e-bike to hang a Ride of Silence banner large enough for passing cars to read. Renee Bannister is a cycle instructor with Bike Durham, teaching adult and teen classes. She's also a member of Black Girls Do Bike and Major Taylor Cycling Club of North Carolina. Bannister describes herself as a recycler because she became reacquainted with biking during the pandemic after years of being off two wheels. And she said, "We need to educate adults who are already driving. We need to educate teenagers who go through driver's ed, and we also need to educate cyclists to cycle smartly, to cycle safely, because one bad apple does spoil the whole bunch. Before I became a cyclist, cyclists got on my nerves. Now that I'm a cyclist, the first thing I notice is visibility." The route swept down Main Street, through Brightleaf Square and the Duke East Campus, along 9th Street and Trinity Avenue, finally looping around Mangum and Roxborough Street, where a small handful of drivers made excessive use of their horns while waiting impatiently for the horde of cyclists to move through the streets. The riders were mostly undisturbed. Roxborough Street and Mangum Street flow north-south through downtown Durham and are notorious for speeding and crashes. Between 2018 and 2023, Roxborough saw 748 crashes, Mangum saw 430. Both are part of Durham's High Injury Network, that's HIN Roads, identified by the city's Vision Zero plan as boasting, a higher than normal rate of traffic incidents. Bike safety advocates say redesigning Durham's HIN is critical to reach Vision Zero, a multinational movement to reduce traffic deaths and serious injuries. The city of Durham adopted a Vision Zero action plan in April of last year, committing to 50% reduction in traffic deaths by 2035. While fatalities in Durham dropped from 37 in 24 to 23 in 25, serious injuries spiked 26% last year. The Roxborough-Mangum corridor has been a high priority for Durham's transport advocates. A plan to convert that road pair back to two-way streets was approved back in 2020. At the end of last year, residents were able to catch a glimpse of what two-way conversion could look like at an open house held by Durham Transport Department and the North Carolina DOT, as well as Santec Consulting Services, the firm who produced the early designs. At Monday's City Council work session, advocates got a welcome update. Egan announced the Roxborough and Mangum Street Corridor project received the rest of the necessary funding, a little over $1 million, from the city to continue contracting with Stantec to develop a full redesign of the street pairing. NCDOT, which owns both roads, also signed off on moving forward with the redesign, a key component of the process. The final design process is scheduled to be completed January of 2028. Talmadge said during the pre-ceremony for the ride, "We appreciate the steps that have been taken by our elected officials in Durham. We appreciate the work of the staff to move these projects. It's not enough, and we're going to continue coming out until all the streets are safe for everybody in Durham, whether you're biking, walking on scooters. The streets belong to us, and they need to be safe." And let's stay in Durham, and let's talk about the tennis community. It has deep roots, and players want better courts to match the growth of the sport. And there's an update to this. After this story published, Durham's city manager presented a proposed budget that includes $3 million for athletic court improvements. Details on how that would be spent weren't immediately available. That's the update, and now the article. On Saturday mornings, dozens of eager tennis players descend on the courts at Elmira Avenue Park in East Durham for an intense competition and lighthearted camaraderie, a tradition that dates back decades. Some players, like 86-year-old Laverne Harper, have played at Elmira since it was built back in 1978. On one such recent day, Bruce Parker, another regular, demonstrated Harper's age and dedication to the game by pinching dirt between his fingers. "You see this stuff right here? He ain't quite as old as that." When players aren't hitting volleys across the net, they're sending friendly barbs back and forth at each other about their performance on the courts. For hours, they sit in lawn chairs and gossip with snacks and refreshments in hand as they serve up stories about their lives in Durham. "Every week is an event," said Harper. Most of the group is made up of older black residents who adopted Elmira as their home court after it was opened in the 70s, when courts where black players felt welcome were more limited. Nowadays, the eight courts there are well-loved but increasingly difficult to play on, with gaping fissures and warped surfaces from water damage and poor drainage that make it more precarious for everyone, especially the older players, to navigate. The tennis courts at Elmira aren't the only ones in need of a facelift either. Durham tennis players, spearheaded by the Eno Community Tennis Association, that's Eno, CTA, have been advocating for updates to these courts for years, arguing upgrades would not only benefit local players, but also attract regional and national tournaments that bring in significant tax revenue for the host city. Based on their advocacy, Durham Parks and Rec is recommending $7 million to address a backlog of tennis court improvements. Local tennis lovers will find out if those projects are getting funded when a draft of the upcoming budget is presented May 18th. And I've already read you that it had been. It's just so important to us that we continue to develop the community around tennis, said Adrian Charleston, a regular at Elmira, who spoke at a March public hearing alongside her 8-year-old son, Lightning. Every weekend, me and my mom, said Lightning, go to Elmira Park to play tennis and hang out with their friends called the Old Man Crew. When we don't play tennis, we sit under a tree and laugh, crack jokes, and talk each other's heads off. Tennis has steadily grown in the Triangle area in recent years, according to the NC chapter of the U.S. Tennis Association, that's USTA, the nonprofit which oversees the competition circuit throughout the country, culminating in its signature event, the U.S. Open Championship. Matches and tournaments are administered by local USTA chapters, like Eno, which took over administering the matches from DPR in 2024, and is the primary organizer for most of the recreational tennis in Durham. The results allow players to see how they stack up against other regions and players of all skill levels, including the likes of world-class professionals Coco Gauff and Naomi Osaka, though don't expect to see them on a Durham court anytime soon. In 2015, 375 teams were participating in USTA's five main leagues in Durham. Once again, that's 375 teams. 10 years later, that number had risen to 640 teams, encompassing more than 8,000 registered players. Since 2023 alone, Triangle-wide program registration for leagues and events have increased by 9.7%. Durham has experienced the biggest growth in registration, over 18%. But dozens of Durham's courts, including Elmira Avenue, have not been upgraded recently, even as demand rises. Facilities aren't always fully functional. Lights don't work, nets are down, courts have cracks, which can cause scheduling issues when groups like Eno CTA are coordinating matches, said CTA board president Mary Long, a longtime Durham resident who picked up tennis during the COVID lockdown. Zach Jakowski, vice president of Eno CTA, said the group will occasionally partner with private schools and tennis clubs to use their courts, but maintaining the network of public ones is the top priority, saying, we've got great public court infrastructure. We'd love to get new courts built, but right now people are just begging to get the lights fixed and the crater, if you will, squared away. DPR, of course that's Durham Public Rec, manages 57 courts in total across 12 parks. All but two, Northgate and Oval Drive, have lights for folks to play into the evening hours. The city has made some recent investment in tennis infrastructure. Courts at Southern Boundaries Park and Forest Hills were resurfaced in 24, and in 25, new outdoor lighting was installed at W.D. Hill Rec Center. At the end of 23, a dozen courts were built at Piney Wood Park exclusively for pickleball, a frenemy of tennis, and additional pickleball courts were added at Sherwood Park. Money for court improvements has been included in the city's capital improvement plan, which lays out long-term infrastructure projects. But according to DPR business service analyst Emily McIntosh, the extent of the repairs needed has historically been underestimated and, in turn, underfunded, leading to a backlog. Councilmember Carl Rist, an avid tennis player himself, said the city recognized we've had this money to resurface courts in the plan but haven't always budgeted properly, and so we sort of end up not completing projects. I think they realized we've got a big backlog. We just need to do this all one year and get caught up. Throughout the 20th century, segregation and racism kept black players out of most tennis facilities, especially in the South. Long before two black sisters from Compton, California, became the faces of tennis worldwide, black players were barred from participating in the highest levels of competition, and it wasn't until 1950 that world-class tennis pro Althea Gibson broke that color barrier, becoming the first black player to compete in the U.S. Open, later winning her first U.S. Open in 1957, and a decade later, in 1968, the tennis legend Arthur Ashe became the first black male athlete to win the tournament. During their rise, Gibson and Ashe would travel to Durham for tournaments at the Algonquin Tennis and Social Club. That's a Fayetteville Street facility, now the site of the W.D. Hill Recreation Center, established in 1922 by Durham's black residents determined to have a space of their own for recreation, business, and political meetings, and socializing. And in 1935, this was where the group, now known as the Durham Committee on the Affairs of Black People, was formed. Durham didn't just play host to out-of-town talent. Hillside High School, an all-black school at the time, mounted an impressive run of success in the 1950s and 60s. Both the men's and women's teams dominated high school teams in North Carolina. The Hillside boys team won 8 straight state singles titles from 1953 to 1960, led by their coach, Carl Bear Easterling. Among Hillside's illustrious tennis alums, Irwin Holmes, who won the 1956 state singles title and doubles title, went on to become the team captain at North Carolina State University and the school's first black graduate. Joe Williams, winner of the 1960 state title, touts an impressive win over Ashe during their young careers. John Lucas II, son of Titanic educator John Lucas, was an All-American tennis and basketball player at the University of Maryland after graduating from Hillside. And Bonnie Logan, 3-time girls singles champion from 65 to 67, became the first black player to join the Virginia Slims Professional Women's Tour in 1971. Harper remembers the humble beginnings from which he and the other Hillside standouts came. Each time they played at Algonquin, they were responsible for rolling out the clay courts and relining its boundaries. Before they could afford tennis rackets, an engineering professor in the neighborhood made them wooden paddles. The kids would practice their forehands by hitting tennis balls against the back wall of the club. Now an elder in the tennis community, Harper serves as a mentor and inspiration to young upstarts like Charleston and Lightning, who live in the neighborhood next to Elmira Park. Harper and others who play there have become a found family for the mother and son duo. Charleston and Lightning even received a coveted invitation to the 80th birthday party for Elmira's most fashionable tennis player, Bernadette, Ms. Bernie, David Yerumo. Lightning first picked up a racket 4 years ago when Charleston signed him up for group lessons at the park. One of the other parents convinced Charleston to grab a racket, too. Lightning, a multi-sport athlete, enjoys playing tennis in part because of his mom's newfound love for the sport. He says he wants his mom to keep getting better and can only beat her, quote, when she's very tired. For Charleston, involvement in tennis now expands far beyond Elmira Park. In 2022, she became the chair of the DEI Committee for USTA North Carolina, working with partners across the Southeast to make the sport more accessible, especially for black colleges and universities. Growing up, Charleston used to drive an hour and a half from her hometown of Granite Quarry to Durham and volunteer for Habitat for Humanity. She's now turned her penchant for public service toward building a stronger, more diverse tennis community. Saying, in order to be able to offer suggestions, you need to have a seat at the table. Based on feedback from players, DPR is proposing over $7 million in repairs and upgrades at six parks: Whippoorwill, Rock Quarry, Maureen Road, W.D. Hill, Garrett Road, and Elmira. Repairs include resurfacing and lighting, as well as tree pruning and drainage to support overall court stability. While these courts are awaiting repairs, casual players have fewer options. They can book a court with surfacing issues like Elmira, or if they're lucky, find one in good condition that isn't reserved by Eno CTA, which needs playable courts for their official USTA events. Eno CTA spends about $60,000 annually on court rentals and lighting fees to host these USTA-sanctioned tournaments and other events. I'm now going to interrupt this to see that there are several photographs in the Indie Week article which show the nature of some of these, I don't call them gullies and chasms in these paved tennis courts, not the asphalt one. These are supposed competition courts. Some of them look like, like Death Valley, you might say. All right, well, public courts increase accessibility to the sport by offering more affordable fees than private courts and programs that help reduce the costs associated with the equipment and lessons. A player's essential needs are a decent racket and a good pair of tennis shoes, which most folks wear every day. Groups like Eno CTA and the Durham Orange Community Tennis Association give away secondhand rackets to beginners, and the Tri-Tennis Program from USTANC offers $50 beginner clinics for children and adults. Sigjowski explained, that's why we need robust and open public courts, especially if there's enough where you don't have to reserve them or don't go through the city to pay that extra fee. If you could just show up and walk on, it saves money, gives a little bit more access, and makes it more accessible broadly. Sigjowski and others are also quick to emphasize the health benefits of playing tennis, which one study says you can nearly add 10 years to your life compared to a more sedentary lifestyle, or even other sports like soccer. Harper and David Yeruma, both in their 80s, point to the habit of weekly tennis as a major contributor to their quality of life, though Harper says he avoids playing against the young up-and-comers, like Elmira's rising 8-year-old tennis star, Lightning. Players say improvements could also help Durham attract regional tournaments, which can bring in millions of dollars in court rentals and sales tax to host cities. Currently, those events and that money are going to places like Raleigh and Cary. In Wake County, the 24-acre Cary Tennis Park hosts 32 public courts, boasting electronic scoreboards and permanent seating at the park's premier court. Construction for that began in 2002, and since then, the town of Cary has continued to invest in upgrades and new features that attract hundreds of thousands of visitors and allow Cary to host dozens of tournaments, bringing in $3 million in annual economic impact, according to the town of Cary's website. Sigjowski said, every meaningful city outside of Durham has the core capacity to do a state tournament and bring in that revenue. And so we are costing ourselves as a city money by not having a regular maintenance schedule, by not taking care of the courts. Whether Elmira Park receives the upgrades in this year's budget won't deter Harper, Charleston, and others from returning to continue their weekly tradition. Sigjowski says 27 million people in this country play tennis. They're not all members of country clubs. Most tennis happens on public courts. And there's a rich history, you know, from Arthur Ashe to Jimmy Connors to the Williams sisters. We can continue that legacy if we continue funding it and investing in tennis around the country, and specifically in Durham. Well, we heard a little bit about Kerry's extensive investment in public and municipal tennis. Let's talk about another article featuring Kerry spending $330,000 on videos which taxpayers were never meant to see. Dancing Queens, a case study. That's a video the town of Kerry commissioned at a cost of $35,000, tells the story of a handful of town staffers who spent months planning a surprise dance performance for their colleagues and bosses. It plays a bit like a workplace mockumentary, where the actors deliver their lines in earnest, and only the audience can see the humor in what's unfolding. Scene 1. The camera pans across an industrial chic event space filled with cheerful-looking professionals in business casual. It's the first night of a two-day staff retreat in Wilmington. Michael Jackson's Don't Stop Till You Get Enough plays softly in the background as they mingle and chit-chat. Their champagne flutes are embossed with the town of Kerry logo. Cut to a microphone stationed at the front of the room. "We have one more special test for tonight," announces Chief Strategy Officer Susan Moran. Standing behind her is then Town Manager Sean Stiegel. Moran starts to tell a story about how years ago Stiegel had the idea to end the annual retreat with a performance by staff. Cut to Stiegel, nodding and grinning bemusedly. Moran says, "Those of you who have been on the council know we've never done that. Until tonight." The lights dim. The opening glissando of ABBA's disco anthem Dancing Queen plays. The crowd erupts into applause. Fade to black. Scene 2. We've moved locations to a sun-washed room. It's 9 months later, per a banner at the bottom of the screen. Four women in blazers and slacks are sitting in director's chairs. On the tables between them are four Town of Kerry logos angled carefully toward the camera. Moran asks her collaborators, "How does the Dancing Queens experience exemplify our culture, and what are we trying to do at all levels in the organization?" Planning Director Heather Whelan says, "I think taking a risk, number one, putting yourself out there, being vulnerable." Moran rests her chin in her hand and nods thoughtfully. Cut to a close-up on Whelan, who continues, "It started as this is a present for Sean and council, and it's for the retreat, and it became a commitment to our colleagues and the relationships we're forming along the way." Made in 2024, Dancing Queens includes studio interviews with a dozen town staffers, B-roll from rehearsals, several clips from Mamma Mia, the movie To Break Up in 6 chapters. The film builds and builds to the final performance, a 4-minute professionally choreographed dance break by staff members decked out in go-go boots and shiny disco pants. Parentheses, the town did not pay for the choreographer or the costumes, Moran told Indy. Between 2021 and 25, the town of Kerry spent more than $330,000 to produce 12 documentary-style videos about town projects and culture, including Dancing Queens, all at Stiegel's direction. The videos range in length from under 5 minutes to nearly 30 minutes. They were all made for internal use only and were not intended for broad public viewing. The indie obtained them, along with associated invoices and emails, through a public records request. Stiegel, who resigned in December of 25, did not respond to a request for comment for this story. As the title suggests, Dancing Queens aims to be a case study, an illustration of Kerry Town staff's exceptional teamwork and creativity. Stiegel commissioned the documentary after the performance because he thought it exemplified camaraderie and risk in government work, said Moran. Some of the other videos are about Kerry's history, its environmental programs, and its housing plan. For a series of 5 10-minute videos from 2023, various council and staff members dissected the town's motto, Live Inspired, what it means, how to do it, and where they get their inspiration. The sixth video in that series is a blooper reel. Moran told Indy, Sean Stiegel was an enthusiastic advocate for video. He felt like video could convey thoughts and emotions and move people in ways the written word or in person simply couldn't. It was under Sean's direction we started producing these. Together, the videos offer a glimpse into Kerry's government under Stiegel, who helmed the organization for almost a decade. On their face, he comes off as an adept leader who spearheaded big projects, motivated the people around him to be better public servants, and cultivated a fun, inclusive culture in Town Hall. After Stiegel resigned, the town revealed he had a, quote, over-the-top spending and inadequate financial reporting, and credited an unhealthy work environment for staff. Whistleblowers reported Stiegel to Mayor Harold Weinbrech, who told Indy in January he learned the former manager's behavior had been, quote, unpredictable and inappropriate. 4 separate investigations into his conduct by the Wake County District Attorney's Office, State Auditor, State Bureau of Investigation, and a law firm hired by the town are ongoing. Given Stiegel's resignation and the ensuing investigations, the self-congratulatory, sentimental tone of the videos and their price tag now feels misguided. Stiegel's legacy in Kerry is complicated. He saw a period of hugely successful growth and development for the town. He envisioned downtown Kerry Park as a marquee destination and helped make it happen. He established the 311 service for Kerry residents. He also depleted the town savings. He dismantled Kerry's budget office and communications office, Moran told Indy. The videos show the good he did and also illustrate some of the bad. Moran said, Sean was an agent of change. He also, as we can all see now, lacked a good judgment when it came to spending. Assistant Director for Citizen Information and Outreach, Carolyn Roman, told Indy, just like so many other things, he just took it too far. A step too far, agreed Moran. Many of the videos celebrate the hard work and creativity of the staff at Kerry Town Hall. Roman said to have somebody want to invest resources to document the magnificent work of what staff were doing felt really good. But at times, the videos devolve into platitudes and boosterism. Then Town Council member Don France reflects on one of the videos from the 2023 Retreat series. Be your best self. Be the best place to live. Be the best place to work. Be the best. To me, that's what Live Inspired means. In that same video, then Assistant Town Manager Dan Alt monologues on how the town of Kerry is able to do meaningful things. Quote, it's incredibly hard, and it takes you across the landscape to a variety of different, I'm going to use the term, geographies. I'm thinking of it in terms of different concepts, different things you have to encounter when you're trying to do something special. It's beyond what you can imagine. Parenthetically, Alt resigned about a month after Stiegel. In the video Legacy of Leadership, about Kerry's history, made in 2024, the narrator, Will Lyman, PBS Frontline, whom the town paid $10,000, said Moran, describes the town's national and international reputation as the place to relocate to. At the end of the video, Lyman name-checks Stiegel's book, The Top of the Arc. Quote, new leaders in government, business, and community are bringing fresh energy into Kerry to meet the opportunities we have today, whether by establishing a dynamic collection of breweries or by creating a park to fulfill a commitment to keep Kerry at the top of the arc. We have built on the legacy of leadership that Kerry is known for. The music swells. Leadership not formed from a training manual or prescribed by ideology, but leadership born from a personal promise to ourselves and to each other to always put carry first, to collaborate and cross those myriad of aisles and boundaries that both separate and define us as individuals, but collectively contribute to the diverse fabric that makes carry the best place, the brightest star, the beacon for hope and opportunity for those who choose to call her home. The least expensive video in the set, the indie obtained, Environmental Excellence, is 8 minutes long and cost $20,000 to make. The most expensive, Inspiration Lives Here, the story of downtown Kerry Park, is 20 minutes and cost $70,000. The series of 6 short videos and the town's motto, Live Inspired, cost $61,000 total. Legacy of Leadership, 10 minutes long, cost $63,000, including that $10,000 voiceover fee and a $5,000 fee to license the background song, A Sky Full of Stars, from Coldplay and the Piano Guys. The most expensive videos in the set included sweeping drone shots filmed around Kerry, a large number of studio interviews, and a large quantity of B-roll footage. All the videos were made by Digital P, a local production studio run by former Town of Kerry employee Peyote Perryman. Digital P also produces the town's educational Kerry Matters video series, makes commercial for the town, and films the council meetings. The town began using Digital P a few years after Stiegel arrived in 2016, Moran said, in part because Stiegel's decision to dismantle the communications department, which had been responsible for video production. According to Moran, Stiegel wanted the videos to be high-end. He came up with a general concept and sometimes made specific requests, like that Lyman voiceover. Then he tasked Moran, whose job encompasses strategic communications and special projects, and who reported directly to him, with figuring out the details with Perryman. Moran wrote in a 2023 email to Perryman, "This song has special meaning to me, and I hadn't thought about it for a while. Then I heard a slow version just on television for a Make-A-Wish commercial. Let's do some thinking together about this in the new year." When Moran bought Stiegel a cost estimate for a video, she recalled he would invariably approve it, telling her, "Whatever it takes, spend the money." Moran said how things looked was very important to Sean. He would say, "It's not form or function, it's both form and function." The videos, which were shown to new council members and staff at professional conferences and by the Kerry Chamber of Commerce, were not screened to the broader public or made available online, according to emails the Indie obtained. "Dancing Queens was screened at a department director's meeting," said Moran. As she understood it, Stiegel believed the videos could help impress upon viewers the weight of responsibility for the legacy of this place that he purported to love. Since Stiegel resigned, there have been several other reports of questionable or excessive town spending during his tenure. The town disclosed last December that in 2024, Stiegel authorized 2 land purchases worth $1 million total, without the council's knowledge. The News and Observer reported in January the town of Kerry paid about $37,000 toward council member Lori Bush's public policy master's degree at Northwestern University in 2024, without the full town council's knowledge. Bush repaid the town after learning some of her colleagues weren't aware of the payment. The NNO also reported the town of Kerry paid $3,400 for Stiegel to stay in a hotel for 4 nights during a work trip. Also in January, the Indy obtained public records showing the town paid upward of $100,000 to ghostwrite, publish, and market The Top of the Arc, which came out last August. This book about Stiegel's approach to municipal government leadership. The title refers to his vision for keeping Kerry from slipping down the metaphorical arc from its current optimal position. The total cost of the videos across the 5 years they produce comes out to less than 0.01% of Kerry's current $511 million budget. Kerry is widely considered to be financially strong and has long maintained the highest possible credit and bond ratings. At a recent budget meeting, staff shared the town's current fund balance, or savings, is about $125 million, well above the $96 million minimum policy requirements. Dancing Queens was the last video produced under Stiegel, and it was made after the property tax revaluation of 2024, when the total assessed value of residential property in Cary jumped 50%, and homeowners saw their tax bills skyrocket. That year, Cary also raised taxes by 1.5 cents and put 2 bond referenda worth $560 million, more than the town's budget that year, on the November ballot, which voters rejected. Moran said, producing Dancing Queens the same year you institute the largest tax increase in Cary's history is tone deaf. Stiegel should have seen it, and we should have helped him see it. And in the top of the arc, Stiegel recounts a conversation he had with a consultant friend who apparently told him, according to the book, there's a very slight difference between a cult and a culture. A cult requires its charismatic leader to be there, and when the charismatic leader isn't there, it doesn't work. It falls apart or fades. A culture lasts no matter who is in the room. 2 weeks after Stiegel's resignation, on December 27th, Moran emailed the town council members, Digital P's Perryman and Cary's newly sworn-in interim town manager, Russ Overton. It was time to start planning the video for the 26th council staff retreat. All right, folks, and I believe that is about where I can end this. There's not that much else, but I don't quite have enough time to read the remainder of this column to you. It has been fun to read this issue of the Indie Week to you all. I will be back in a week or so with the next edition. And Indie Week, this program, will be available after its initial broadcast as a podcast. And you can find it at ncreadingservice.org. That would be at the webpage. And I hope you'll take advantage of listening to some of the other programs. There are 50 podcasts and news broadcasts available for years and years on our service. So, for John Feddersen, for the North Carolina Reading Service, thanks you all for listening today, and we'll see you next week.